I met the author of Tears of Blood, and he spoke in Seoul, and I had very, very quickly read the book before I went to that event. And I had somehow, my mind had refused to register your age at the time that you translated it. And so I should tell listeners that Paul Taewon Kim, who I'm talking to, translated, and correct me if I'm incorrect, translated Tears of Blood by Yu Yong-bok at the age of 15 years old. Is that correct?
Yeah, I started when I was 15, and I finished when I was 17, so...
Took 2 years. That actually sounds about right from everything I know. So I guess just to start, that's extremely unusual. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about your personal story, you know, how you got where you are?
I'm a second-generation Korean-American. I was born in Pittsburgh, diehard Steelers fan.
Oh, no.
But I've been brought up in California. I've lived here all my life, and I consider myself like a California boy, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And aside from like the book, I like to play soccer, and which has been my hobby like since I was 8 or 9 years old. Despite all this, I consider myself very Korean because in my family we always speak Korean at home, and like all my favorite foods would be Korean food. So like every morning. Mm-hmm. I have rice and a fried egg and some, like, jangjeon to start my day. And so I visit Korea, like, every year at least. So I consider myself a Korean who lives in the United States.
Okay. And your citizenship, however, is United States, right?
Right, yeah. I'm an American citizen.
Okay, which means no threat of the army at any point. Yeah. I'm actually a kimbap and coffee for breakfast myself guy.
Yeah, it's delicious.
Yeah, one of the things that my wife and I agreed on is when we come back to the United States, we cannot live any place that does not have Korean restaurants. Simply won't do.
California, we have great Korean restaurants here.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was in San Jose, so I was right, I was the marketing director for San Jose Evergreen Community College District. So I was right by Santa Clara. And my best friend, Ed Park, teaches Korean at the Defense Language Institute in Monterey. So
yeah, I came on that work there at the
DLI. Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, some good Korean food in that general area. So you said that you speak in your house, you speak Korean. How's your reading? Because reading and writing are very different from speaking.
Yeah. So, because of that, my parents and my grandma have, ever since I was little, had me read books in Korean. And, like, they always have me write letters to my grandma in Korean. I don't have time for that as much anymore, but, like, still for her birthday, you know, we send her a letter that I have to write in Korean.
Mm-hmm.
So we do a lot that in hopes of keeping me, like, up to date with my Korean. And when I was younger, it was, I didn't really like it, you know, it was really dreary. But nowadays, I see that without that, you know, I wouldn't speak I wouldn't be able to read or speak or write as well as I can, so I'm thankful, I guess.
Yeah, parents do that to kids. You'll thank me later.
Yeah, so, I guess they're right, so.
Tell our listeners how it was that you came upon this particular book, Tears of Blood.
So the way that I first found this book was my dad was doing legal research for an NGO that helps South Korean prisoners of war. One of the head of the NGO named Yun Soon Lee, who's a daughter of a South Korean POW herself, came over for lunch one day. And that day she brought us a copy of, in Korean at the time, the title was Starry Nights in Hell, I think.
Right, that's what I recall too from the mm-hmm. intro.
And so I got that book. And this is during my winter break of sophomore year, so I had just turned 15. And that's how I got started. I read the book, and I kind of felt like, you know, this story needed to be told because it's so, like, it's not well known at all outside outside Korea. And, like, people learn about the Korean War in history classes and, like, American kids might know a lot about K-pop, like Psy and like Gangnam Style, but I felt that this story was like, you know, becoming history right now. But the problem is there are still prisoners of war stuck in North Korea that we need to get out. So I felt it was something that needed to be done.
Yeah, when Mr. Yu spoke, he emphasized that he emphasized two things, actually. He said that he would like to get whoever is remaining out, but he also admitted it's a small number. He also said that he just, and you were very, you were key in part of this, he just wanted these voices heard because when he was in the prison camp and in the prison system, that he was afraid, just afraid that his story would go unremarked, that these people and this experience would just disappear from history. So good job for doing that, because you'd certainly have extended that story. I went on Amazon today, as I do, and I was happily surprised to see that you've got a really pretty respectable Amazon rating, which means that people are coming and looking at the book.
Yeah, I've gotten a lot of support from my school and, you know, my friends, my teachers, and then my family, so...
Yeah, good.
It's been good.
Well, yeah, like I said, I was surprised. You have numbers that are sort of equivalent to Kim Jung Ha's back catalog, which is very, very respectable. You said also in our email correspondence that you normally visit Seoul every year, but you cannot make it this year because you're applying to colleges?
Yeah, so right now is college app season for high school seniors. Most of my applications are due like January 1st. So this winter break is going to be spent working on those.
So when is the next time you anticipate being in Seoul?
Possibly over spring break, because I'd like to meet with Mr. Yu one more time, at least. But that might not be possible, and it might just go over the summer.
Okay, well, not that far away.
But definitely within the next 6 months.
Okay, good. So you go back and forth, so you're relatively bicultural here and maybe completely bicultural. Talk about the things that you really like about Korea that are different from the United States, and then maybe we'll do that in reverse. But let's start with the things that are really key to you, that you really enjoy about Korea.
The biggest thing about Korea for me is I spend most of my time in Seoul.
Mm-hmm.
And the energy and the vibrant, like, feeling of stuff is happening in Seoul. That's something that I really enjoy. Just because here in the United States, we live in a suburb, and so it's pretty quiet, and there's not much going on. But I love how in Seoul I can take a walk at 11:30 at night, and there'll be countless people on the streets. There'll be, like, street vendors trying to sell me some hotdog.
Mm-hmm.
There's restaurants that are all open, you know, great places to go, things to see. And what ties into that is the great freedom that I had as a kid in the city, because in the United States, you need a car to get anywhere. But in Korea, you know, they have buses, they have trains, they have taxis, so you can go get anywhere you need to get, and age is kind of no barrier to exploring the city. And then there's, like, the other great things are, of course, the food. You've got, like, the Chisung Saida, which is the best soda I've ever had, and I don't know why they don't have it in the U.S. and then, like, great, every single restaurant you go, it's just so good. And so I've always felt bad for those Korean kids, like, maybe middle school or high school, because they live in this, like, world where it's so perfect for kids to have a great time. You know, you have your friends nearby, like, everything you need is all set up, but they have to spend all that time in hagwons and studying for college and stuff, so.
Yeah, the first time I saw kids coming out of a hagwon at, like, 11:30, I was sitting in front of a store, you know, at a table, and I didn't understand what it was. I had to ask my fellow foreign friends, what's going on? They're like, oh, they're getting out of class. I couldn't believe it. But you touch on something that I think everyone who comes to Seoul loves, which is the 24/7 nature of it and how publicly life is lived, which sort of like to me, initially, it was like an ongoing celebration. Wherever you went, something exciting and vital was happening. And I'd also just add, yeah, I don't have a car. And man, I love that.
Yeah, it's a very, very nice feeling to just know that there's no place that you can't go. I don't have my license in the United States yet, but like it's not too bad. But in Korea, I mean, you don't need a car; you can just get anywhere.
Yeah, and I lived in the same area you did. I lived very close to Mountain View, and actually, relatively speaking, for the United States, there is really good public transportation, but it is just does not compare to Seoul or Korea.
Right.
In general, it's amazing. Okay, let's turn to the book a little bit, because, you know, my interest is in translation, primarily literature, but as I read any translation, I'm kind of doing two things. I'm reading the book, and I'm kind of trying to judge, assess to some extent what went on in the translation and how well the translation worked. And when I met Mr. Yu, one of the things I really noticed was that he was a very plain-spoken, almost blunt man. His Korean is... when he speaks, his Korean was very, very simple compared to some literary authors who I've tried to listen to and simply couldn't. And then as I read the book, I was also I also noticed that the writing style is extremely precise and direct. And was this a function of the text that was there, a function of the fact that you were an evolving translator? How did it, or just luck, a good match? How would you talk about the translation process?
In general, I think that there is a bit of luck, because when I write, I try to write to the point and a little more blunt, just because I don't consider myself a good enough writer to write eloquent, fancy statements. It also was a bit of my effort to match with Mr. Yu's writing style, because it kind of the simplicity of his writing really made the story almost stronger, because it was kind of the opposite of like propaganda. It didn't feel like there was a filter. It was just, this is my life, this is what happened. I'm not going to try and over dramatize it for you, because I think that this story is tragic enough that it doesn't need that. You know, this is just the facts, and the facts are enough. And I really like that, so I tried to emulate that when I translated it.
Yeah, and as I said, it did seem like a really good match that you caught, that in that book you really caught some aspects of his personality. You say something strange, though, to me as someone who's deeply involved in language and literature and translation, and that is that you don't, and you also said this in our email correspondence, you said you don't consider yourself a language person, you consider yourself a math and science person. So is this what you're going to study, do you think, when you go to university?
I'm really not sure exactly what I'm going to study. This is something that I've said to many people. What I've learned from translating this book is that I'd like to help others and maybe support those who are being forgotten, like Mr. Yu, or in a difficult situation. But I'm not sure exactly how I'm going to do that. So sometimes I feel like I want to do economics. And then other times I like to work in biotechnology. But I don't think I've ever considered myself as someone who wanted to pursue writing as a career. And that's not to say that writing can't help people. It's just not something that is really my passion.
It makes sense to me. You said something in there that's sort of funny, because at the outset of the interview you said you consider yourself to some extent a Korean in the United States. But I think if I asked most Korean high school students what they were going to be and what they were going to study in university, that would have been determined for them long, long since.
Mm-hmm.
How traditional are your parents?
I consider myself very, very blessed to have parents who are infinitely supportive of whatever I try to do. There's a couple careers that I think that I would never be able to do, and that would be like a doctor,
mm-hmm.
because I don't think that I could handle like the memorizing everything in med school that you have to do,
right.
Or like being a lawyer, just like very, very typical professions for a middle or upper middle class Korean American boy. And instead, you know, my parents are very, very, they want me to find what makes me happy. And so, like, when I was, a great story that exemplifies this would be when I was very little, I think I was 9 or 10, our family had heard about these soccer camps that they had in Brazil. And they're these, like, camps for kids that, they take kids from Korea, they take kids from the United States. And they just, you know, they play soccer, and apparently, like, there's these amazing stories about how kids, like, come out amazing players, and they remember why they played soccer again, and they're just loving it. And when we heard about that, you know, I mentioned offhand, hey, it would be cool to try that. And so, like, from there, my dad was actually nice enough to create a small fund for me so that if I so really so desired to do this, if I wanted to, you know, have a shot at playing professionally, soccer professionally, then I would, he was supporting me to actually send me to Brazil to the soccer camp. And I, when I learned that, you know, this wasn't just an offhand joke. I mean, I learned this only like last year. I was pretty moved by my own dad. So
that is
I'd say I'm very, very lucky.
That is a remarkable story. And yeah, you are lucky. So let's get going back to the translation a little bit as we sort of wind it up. The translation, what were the biggest hurdles you faced, not only in the translation, but many, many things in Korea have been translated but not published. So what were the hurdles in translation and publication?
In terms of publication, it wasn't as difficult because we had already worked out with One Books, the publisher of the Korean version, that they would translate the book for us. And we were actually lucky enough to get a sponsor for the first few thousand copies. Thomas Youngbong Chung, he heads an NGO in Los Angeles that supports Korean prisoners of war.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so the hardest thing I'd say about the translation would be the differences between culture and language, between Korean and English, and Korea and the United States. To begin, you know, the language was very, very, it was what took, I think, the most time, just because there's so many words and descriptions that Mr. Liu used that don't really have direct English translations. You could type them into a translator and they wouldn't really tell you that there isn't really a word that says that means the exact same thing. And a good example of this would be like the title, Tears of Blood. This is actually, in Korean, it was the expression "pinunmu."
Yeah.
And it, in Korean, this means, you know, the pain that you feel when a loved one suffers, and there's nothing you can really do about it. You're kind of helpless to watch as a loved one suffers.
A kind of expression.
But there's no word in English that just in like three syllables can say all that. And so it was very difficult to figure out the right language, and sometimes I'd have to use like a footnote to explain. So the language was a big issue. And then the other hard part would be the culture. So while I'm pretty up to, like, I have a vague understanding of modern Korean history. I know as much as we've had some dictators and now, or I knew as much as we've had some dictators and now we have a democracy after the Korean War. Aside from that, I didn't really know, like, what order those, like, Park Chung-hee or Chun Doo-hwan or all those people came in. And I didn't know, like, a lot about Korean history before the Korean War. And so there was a lot of things historically that I needed to look up. And I actually ended up having to read a book by Professor Bruce Cummings.
Yes, yes.
Korea's Place in the Sun. And I have an interesting story about that, which we can get back to later. And that helped me catch up with a lot of history. And then the third problem would be the culture, because culturally, between Korea and the United States, or 1950s to 1970s Korea and the United States are just two completely different worlds. And so there were so many things that I had to describe, like, there's one part where North Korea, or the North Korean government, has stopped supplying the heating material yeontan, that is vital to North Koreans. And so instead they open up a coal mine and they tell the citizens to be productive citizens and go mine for the coal and your own heating material yourself. And when I read that, I had no idea what yuntan was. And so, like, it was things like that. Like, there's just, we haven't used coal or direct, like, coal as a heating material in the United States for, like, over, like, 80 years, I'm pretty sure. So it was pretty shocking to learn that, no, this is just coal, and this was in the 1980s in North Korea.
And
so things like that.
It should be mentioned that Mr. Yu was started out as a coal miner.
Yeah, he did. He started off as a coal miner, but he was lucky enough to have a middle school education, so he qualified for a surveyor school, and he worked really, really hard to get in, and so he was able to kind of establish some sort of a life for himself in North Korea.
Yeah, one of the things that I noted in my review, my on-air review a couple of weeks ago, was one of the amazing things about this story is, even though he is a prisoner of war, he's both sort of inside and outside North Korean culture. I mean, he's working in the country, and this was totally unexpected to me. I expected a much sharper demarcation between sort of something like prison camp, which is one side of the barbed wire, and then the rest of North Korea, which is the other. But he wanders around and has family, and this makes this a really interesting story, made it a really interesting story from my perspective, because it wasn't just sort of the gulag story. It was also a story of all these social connections.
Yeah, I thought that was... It provided some insight into what life is like for just a very low-level person in North Korea. And it also struck me because it's not really just one of your typical war stories. It's a more human story. And more than half the book is about a father trying to provide for his children. And that's very universal. So his story is very, very key in those respects.
Yeah, and in fact, he doesn't make his escape until essentially he has outlived most of his family in North Korea.
Yes, it's pretty sad that, you know, he had to see some of his children die before he could, or some of his younger brothers and sisters die before he escaped.
Yeah.
But, and what is kind of, what's telling about this is that North Korea and South Korea are not really, like, the border that's been established between the two countries isn't really a real legitimate border. Because it's the two societies are in many respects very similar, and the people are still similar, and so I think that's why there is some confusion on Mr. Yu's own identity. But I think that Mr. Yu's identity is a Korean, you know, not North Korean, not South Korean, but a Korean, and he epitomizes what it means to be a Korean, which is, you know, you support your family, you work hard, and you try and make the most out of whatever difficult situation you find yourself in.
Yeah, that is a very, very strongly Korean story there. And you talked about the title, Tears of Blood, and just a really pretty good expression of Han. And his whole story, his whole family story is like that, as you say. He's got a family on either side of the line, the arbitrary line. The arbitrary line keeps moving on him for the beginning of his story. It was interesting. I did not expect from the title that he actually basically was a prisoner of war three times.
Well, twice, yeah.
Well, he gets caught by the South Koreans.
Mm-hmm.
He gets trapped in North Korea. Oh, not a prisoner of war. He's trapped, right. And so let me make sure I have this right. Refugee, then twice prisoner of war.
Right. It's a pretty incredible story.
It is just amazed me at how it's very, very difficult for someone who was raised as I was in the area you were to understand how fluid and how changeable life was at that time. And this story really, really demonstrates that sort of the changeability and fluidity. And then, as you say, at the same time, the very traditional desire to settle down and have a family and do the things one does during life.
Right. It seems like he's just a normal guy who's had all these, or not a normal guy, a very, very strong and very, very determined man who's had all these pressures of the outside world just thrown upon him. And this is his way of, his story describes how he made it out.
Yeah, and I would say that he was a normal guy at the beginning. He was just some guy who was caught up in all this stuff. You're absolutely correct that his inner strength is, as you read the story, I was at least boggled by his inner strength and his commitment. He basically went wherever he was, he set himself down with his goals and he achieved them the best he could. But yeah, he was just some guy with his family when the story starts, and it ends some 60 years later with him back in North Korea. I'm sorry. It ends some 60 years later with him back in South Korea writing this book. So before I let you go, you said two things. One, is there anything for many of our listeners on Arirang are outside of Korea, 180 countries or something like that. Is there anything that you would, how would you explain Korea to them? And also, I'd like to finish with the Cummings story that you mentioned earlier.
How would I explain Korea to an outside, someone not from Korea?
Yeah, and not from the United States either. I mean, we have listeners in Malaysia, we have listeners, I mean, basically all over the world.
I think that Korea is a place that has a great deal of potential. And for hundreds of years in the past, it's never been able to fully realize that potential. It's been caught in between, you know, two superpowers in East Asia, Japan and China. And so it has always been kind of the odd man out between the three. And just lately, you know, with the global, through globalization and through a lot of hard work from the previous generation, we're just starting to achieve this, achieve our potentials, as it were. And with that, you know, there comes a lot of growing pains, I think, but Korea is a country that wants to move forward and is very, very competitive, always trying to be, you know, at the top of whatever they do. I think that even though we may be going through some growing pains right now, and there may be this horrible DMZ that separates the two countries, but in the end, we have the drive and we have the strength to move forward.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good description. One thing that always impressed me about Korea as soon as I got here, you said when Korea turns its mind to something, it happens, is that when South Korea, I'm talking about at this moment, but when Korea does set its mind to something, it routinely punches well above its weight. You know, it accomplishes at a level, I think, at a soccer team. I think the Korean national soccer team.
Mm-hmm.
You got a pretty small country with not so many fields, and yet that team just achieves, and POSCO and Samsung and all that stuff. It really is amazing what Korea does when it puts its mind to it. So This leaves us with one thing before we're goodbye, the Bruce Cummings story.
After reading Tears of Blood in Korean and realizing that I really need some sort of background on Korean history, my parents or someone suggested that I read Tears of Blood, because, you know, it, or not Tears of Blood, Korea's Place in the Sun,
right,
by Cummings, because, you know, Professor Cummings is probably the eminent historian on Korean modern history. And so I did read it, and it taught me just so much that helped me write the footnotes and everything. And so once the book was published, I actually sent out, or when we were in the stages of publishing it, I sent out an email to several professors, and I also sent an email to Professor Cummings thanking him for, you know, the book and telling him, like, how important the book was for his, or for how important Korea's Place in the Sun was in my translation process. And he actually responded, and he offered to take a look at my manuscript. And so then I asked him if he could write a little review or some sort of forward praise that we could put on the book, and he consented. And so he not only wrote the book that taught me Korean history, he also, like, did a very thorough reading of Tears of Blood and even sent me, like, a list of these footnotes are wrong. Not that long of a list, thankfully, but still, it was nice to know that a professor, like, checked up on them, and wrote a review. And so, you know, I'm so grateful for, the support that he showed for me, and, that, you know, he gave this 16-year-old kid from California a chance. And I'm very grateful for that.
That is a great story, and that is tremendous. That's what you hope professors would be like. Well, Paul Taewon Kim, I'd like to thank you. Paul Taewon Kim is the translator of Tears of Blood, A Korean POW's Fight for Freedom, Family, and Justice, written by Korean author Yoo Young-bok. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Okie doke. I hope to see you when you come in spring or summer.
I hope to see you when I get there.